Puerto Rican statehood looks like it is on its way to happening. Puerto Rico has held 6 non-binding referendums on its status, including becoming a U.S. state since 1967. However, the residents there have most recently voted in favor of statehood. That was last November. This has, I guess, a lot to do with Hurricane Maria, which caused over 3,000 deaths, the worst natural disaster to hit the island to date that we know of. Also, they have $72 billion in debt. They can't file for bankruptcy, so why not just push it into the federal government? I don't mind paying for Puerto Rico, do you?
No.
Yeah. I mean, I actually have less of a problem paying for Puerto Rico than I do for California. I mean, I have a real problem paying for California. If California and New York and Illinois start pushing all of their state debt into the Fed, I am really pissed off. I'm really pissed off. I didn't live there. When I did live in New York, I voted against it because I knew it was insanity. Anyway, it looks like the current governor, who is part of the New Progressive Party, that's not even the Democratic Party. This is the New Progressive Party. Is very, very excited about this. And it looks like the Democrats are going to push it through. So we've got that going for us. But don't worry. Congress could stop it.
And don't forget, Washington, D.C. Could also become a state.
Well, yeah. Isn't that great?
So
you got that going for you.
You got now, here's two a state, super Democratic states here's about
a,
to be added.
Here's a state that they're going to make sure doesn't become a state. And that is Jefferson. Is it Jefferson? The state of Jefferson or Jeffersonian? I never heard of it, and I grew up in the West Coast. But there is a movement now in Northern California that is saying they want to break free. They don't feel that they are being represented at all by the California legislature, and they are conservatives, and they want to become their own state. Do you remember, Pat, were we still together in the 90s when I read some things from, I think it was Dugin, Alexander Dugin, that said the United States was going to break up into 5 districts? And when he was asked why, how do you know that? He said by 2020 or 2015, something like that, the United States would be in a civil war and we would eventually break up into 5 different districts. And when asked why he knew that, he said, because we have people on the ground, meaning they have people pushing for that. And I could see that happening quickly.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. We also have something really, really great happening in the military now. The latest on the Pentagon. The Pentagon is not focusing on the Islamic State or the threat from China or the threat from any place else. They are now doing everything they can to look at the threat from within. President Joe Biden is continuing to not focus on China, in fact, strengthen China while promoting social justice inside the Pentagon. His first military-related executive order was to overturn Trump's transgender policy, which I think we were all fighting for, were we not? Where we're like, this fairness has got to... has got to be upheld here, and somebody needs to free all the transgenders from the oppression in the military. Lloyd Austin, his defense secretary, the first African-American to serve in that position, Austin vowed during his confirmation hearing to rid the military of racists and extremists. Now, I wasn't aware that there were racists and extremists in the military. I mean, I knew that they were jihadists, sure, knew that, but we weren't supposed to talk about it. So he wants to get rid of racists and extremists. Here's the problem. Pat, when you go looking for something and you know that it's there, do you generally find it?
Generally, yes.
Yes. You generally, you know, it's like, have you ever worked at a place where a consultant comes in and the management hires a consultant and says, look, here's what the problem is. The problem is we've got X, Y, and Z. And all the employees are like, that's not the problem. The problem is the management. What do the consultants usually find? A, B, and C or X, Y, and Z? They always find X, Y, and Z. That's what's happening in the Pentagon now. And I want any white extremists out. I want anybody. But what's happening now is the Department of Defense was notified by the FBI 143 times of investigations of former and current military members in 2020. 68 of the times pertain to domestic extremist cases, with the vast majority former military, many unfavorable discharge records, and only 1/4 or 17 had anything to do with white nationalism. So out of 68 times there were extremists, 17 of them had to do with white nationalism. What's really interesting in this story is it doesn't tell me what the others were. The military still has not given even the House Armed Services Committee, the Oversight Committee in Congress, a definition of extremists. We don't know what they're even looking for. They won't define the word. The problem here is that they are going to find what they want, and we're now going to politicize our military. On another front, the now President Joe Biden has pulled 65 pending Trump administration executive orders. Several of the withdrawals strike down orders that would protect American jobs by tightening immigration restrictions, eliminating proposed oversight regulations on how China-backed Confucius Institute operate on campus. This is obscene what is going on. Right now, under current law, outgoing aliens released from custody can seek legal employment. This has now been withdrawn. You can't, we were saying, no, you can't do that. The Trump orders were protecting American workers. Between what he's doing with China and what he's doing with immigration, we have some serious problems coming our way. But the good news is the Biden administration over the weekend said, quote, this administration will not wait for the next mass shooting. He is calling for universal background checks. We have that. We have that. An assault weapons ban. We did that. It did nothing. We did it in the 90s. It did nothing. And legal liability for gun makers. Now, what does that mean? That means if you use the weapon and you kill someone, someone can sue the gun manufacturer. That's like using a car and suing General Motors because you went on a walkway and drove over a lot of people. Now, if the car has automatic pilot and you couldn't turn it off and it caused you to drive, then you could sue GM. But if you chose to drive on a sidewalk and kill a lot of people, you can't sue GM. Under Biden, you'll be able to sue the gun makers. They are going to make it impossible for Americans to be able to defend themselves. By the way, Swalwell has said in the wake of the Capitol riot, we need a 9/11 commission, a white nationalism task force. holy mother of everything that is good and sacred. We need a white nationalism task force. So now they're pushing for a 9/11 commission. And the guy who is doing it is Swalwell. There's no moving on. January 6th is the day that we'll all sadly remember. I think we have to take an approach that we took after September 11th to root out white nationalism. What about the ballpark? Why didn't we have a 9/11 commission after they tried to shoot all of the Republican congressmen? Why? Why didn't we do that? By the way, Swalwell he said that he is sure that God herself was proud of all of this. So he knows that God is a female, which I think we can't say that he's a hypocrite on that, because he was with Christine Fang, and while he was doing the Fang Bang, we heard him scream, "Oh God, oh God, oh God," many times. So maybe God's not only a female, but also Chinese and a spy.
So what do you do when an anti-gun Congress and anti-gun president move into position to infringe on your right to bear arms? Easy. The exact same thing you would do when an outside authority tries to force anything unconstitutional onto constituents. You nullify it. This constitutional tactic is surging as counties and states battle to protect the rights of those they serve. Some groups argue nullification will cause anarchy, or suggest that the Civil War somehow settled the matter. Yet others are successfully using it across the country. We'll look at nullification in this episode of Analysis Behind the News, where we provide the perspective you can use to restore American liberty and independence. So let's start off with a couple of headlines, both from The New American. Missouri resistance. Federal authorities face arrest if they violate citizens' Second Amendment rights, reads the first headline. And Oklahoma governor nullifies Biden's executive order with his own, reads the second. Last week, The New American reported that in Missouri, in an impressive and effective counterattack to the far left's radical agenda, the Newton County Commission in Missouri passed the Second Amendment Preservation Act, which in part declares, "All federal acts, laws, orders, rules, and regulations passed by the federal government, and specifically any presidential administration, whether past, present, or future, which infringe on the people's right to keep and bear arms, as guaranteed by the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 23 of the Missouri Constitution, shall be invalid in the county, shall not be recognized by this county, and specifically rejected by this county, and shall be considered null and void and of no effect in this county." The act also says, "Any and all federal agents trying to enforce the regulations listed in Section 1 shall be subject to arrest by the Newton County, Missouri Sheriff's Department." The act was signed by three county commissioners and the county sheriff. As The New American reported, this law comes in the wake of the Second Amendment sanctuary movement sweeping across the nation since 2019, spurring scores of counties to submit statements of protection for gun rights that the federal government is attempting to overhaul. We can even go back further than 2019 in regards to protecting the Second Amendment. Many states wrote into their constitutions a guarantee to the right to arms. During the last 20 years, some states adopted amendments to strengthen that right. Legislation for concealed carry gained steam over a decade ago, with the majority of states now categorized as shall-issue states. According to the United States Concealed Carry Association, shall issue means that as long as an applicant passes the basic requirements set out by state law, the issuing authority, such as a county sheriff, police department, state police, etc., is compelled to issue a permit. In other words, local law enforcement officials cannot deny an applicant a permit if the applicant meets all of the criteria. Over the last several years, in the next step to restore the right to keep and bear arms, the Second Amendment movement also has pushed permitless, or constitutional carry, which 17 states have adopted. 9 states are now considering this, according to the National Association for Gun Rights. In a page taken from the playbook of those who helped to institute sanctuary cities for progressive causes, some conservatives have pushed for sanctuaries of not just cities, but counties and entire states to be off limits by the federal government from pushing its agenda to strip citizens of their firearms. Incidentally, this gained steam not only during President Obama's administration, but also during President Trump's time in office when he pushed and passed certain gun control measures. Protecting our citizens from the abuses of government authorities is an important duty for all who swear an oath to the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and Thomas Jefferson advocated for this in their writings. Specifically, Madison wrote in favor of nullification in the Virginia Resolutions of 1798 when the federal government exercises powers not granted in the Constitution. He wrote, "The states who are parties thereto have the right and are in duty bound to interpose." In Essay 16 of the Federalist Papers, Hamilton suggests that there are two ways states can interpose through nullification. They have only not to act or to act evasively as the measure is defeated. Jefferson rightly concluded that where powers are assumed which have not been delegated, a nullification of the act is the rightful remedy. Recognizing this, Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt signed an executive order last week, in effect nullifying a couple of President Biden's executive orders. The Biden order to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline and the order to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord have serious implications to Oklahoma oil and gas producers. Governor Stitt laid out his points of Biden's unconstitutional seizure of power in the order and suggested Oklahoma was being prevented from exercising its ability to properly determine how best to steward and develop its natural resources. He concluded, "Now, therefore, I, J. Kevin Stitt, Governor of Oklahoma, by virtue of the power and authority vested in me by the Constitution and laws of the state of Oklahoma, hereby direct every state agency to utilize all civil methods and lawful powers to protect its 10th Amendment powers and challenge any actions by the federal government that would seek to diminish or destroy Oklahoma's ability to encourage job growth and the responsible development of our natural resources within the energy industry." To wrap all of this up, the New American explained that nullification is the recognition that the states and their citizens created the Union and that the Union should answer to them. The concept was first developed by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison as a tool for the states to act when the federal government refuses to abide by the U.S. Constitution. It has been used effectively to thwart many actions to the federal government, such as when Michigan and Wisconsin refused to cooperate with the Fugitive Slave Act in the 1850s. Today, states have passed laws to nullify federal laws against guns within their state borders. And in Michigan, conservatives got a law enacted that kept state officials from helping federal officers use indefinite detention under provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act. So who could be against such a constitutional tool that protects your rights from being usurped by big government? According to the New American, a state legislator in South Dakota recently made news when he opposed a nullification bill on the grounds that it would cause anarchy and that it was one of the causes of the Civil War. This legislator is a director for the Convention of States, an organization working to persuade states to apply for a convention from Congress through Article 5 of the Constitution in order to change the Constitution, which carries the risk of having the entire Constitution thrown open for a rewrite. Do you trust the Biden administration's cronies in Congress, as well as Antifa and BLM, to actually sit out the proceedings? Anyway, Mr. Schneider claimed wholesale nullifying leads to anarchy and nullification of the Constitution itself. What Schneider argued, however, is historically false. Nullification was not an issue in the Civil War at all. Secession was. Contrary to claims otherwise, nullification was never used to defend the institution of slavery. Instead, slavery opponents in states such as Wisconsin and Michigan used nullification to prevent the enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850. How? By simply refusing to cooperate with its enforcement. We should realize, of course, that just one affiliated member of an organization doesn't necessarily represent the whole. However, the Convention of States appears to be a bit unsure of its stand on nullification. On its website, it argues nullification is okay to use in some instances and suggests there are several types of nullification. Then, in other areas of its site, it calls the method extra-constitutional, which suggests that nullification is not based on the Constitution or its provisions. Yet, Article 6 of the Constitution outlines that the Constitution and laws made in accordance with it are the supreme law of the land, and all legislators are bound to obey the Constitution by their oath. And Hamilton, Madison, and Jefferson declare nullification as the correct remedy of usurpations. Plus, as has been pointed out, nullification has been the only tool to work against government tyranny during COVID-19 and is being used as a tool blocking unconstitutional orders coming from Congress and the Biden administration. A constitutional convention can't force compliance with the Constitution, but nullification certainly can. To learn more, download our free Article 6 booklet called The Founder's Brilliant Solution to Big Government. And once you've read it, share it with others and order physical copies to distribute to state legislators who are looking for tools to protect the rights of their constituents. Look for this on the Article 6, Not 5 Action Tool page at jbs.org. And if you're ready to help get this country back on track to ensure liberty and freedom for all continues, then join an organization that can create national results by working locally. Many in your state already are. So apply for membership in the John Birch Society today at jbs.org. Links are in the video description. Who do you know that cares about freedom and independence? Because it's time to act. The very survival of our republic depends on it. I'm Bill Hahn for the John Birch Society, and until next time, stay informed, stay active, and stay safe, patriots.
The reason I mention this is not to refute him, but to say as I'm listening to him talk, it occurred to me, wow.
Get the fuck out of here!
Yeah.
Fuck you.
All right. Funding on American public schools has escalated fantastically. It has gone up many, many times from what it was, and yet the schools never seem to improve. And yet, we never see people like Jesse Jackson protesting outside the public schools, even though black kids can't get a good education seemingly anywhere in the whole city or in the whole state. Now, why is that? Similarly, healthcare. People say healthcare costs keep rising. Why do healthcare costs keep rising? Healthcare costs keep rising for a really simple reason. The guy who's getting the benefit is not the guy who's paying. Now, let me engage in a moment of speculative progressive reasoning for a moment. We have a right, no less for healthcare, we have a right to eat. We have a right to food. Who would deny that the right to prevent ourselves from starvation is as basic a right as healthcare? All right, now let's have Obamacare as applied to food. You will now be allowed to go to the grocery store and order whatever you want. Fill up your cart, you don't have to pay. Somebody else will pay. What's gonna happen? The first thing that will happen is you'll take all kinds of stuff that you don't need. You'll fill your cart, you'll buy 12 cartons of milk and 45 cartons of bologna. And then you go up to the counter, and the grocery store will realize that they can charge whatever they want because you're not paying. So they will escalate their prices. The basic idea is that what's going on, you and the grocery store are conspiring to rip off the taxpayer. A third man is being cheated. And so what's going on with free education, free healthcare, is the taxpayer is being ripped off.
Simultaneously, the hundreds, if not thousands, of bills passed by Republican officials since 2011 that have policed the woman's body and limited female access to contraceptives and to abortion.
We talk about birth control and abortion. Let's set aside for one moment the debate about whether or not abortion is a constitutional right. I would submit that it is not. You can read the Constitution, squeeze lemon juice on it, hold it upside down, it's just not in there.
But let's assume it was. Let's assume it was sort of invisibly there as part of the Bill of Rights. Right up there with free speech and right up there with the right to religion and the right to assembly and so on. Here's my question to you. Why should the abortion right be subsidized when none of our other fundamental rights are? I mean, you have a right to free speech. Does the government give you money to start a newspaper? You have a Second Amendment right to own a gun. Is the government going to buy you a shotgun? You have a right to free assembly. You got to do it on your own time. You have a right to a free exercise of religion. The government's not going to pay for your churches. So since the government pays for none of our other fundamental rights, why does this right get to be in a category of itself?
So let's imagine I'm walking on the riverbank or on the beach, and I have a sandwich. I made it. It's my favorite bologna and cheese sandwich. And I'm walking around getting ready just to whip it out and uncork it and start eating it. When a guy comes up to me and he goes, "Hey man, I'm really hungry. Give me half your sandwich." And so I do. I give him half a sandwich. Now, I would say that this is actually a very virtuous transaction. Why? Because first, I am a good guy. I shared my sandwich. I feel good about myself, and rightly so. And the person who gets the sandwich is a recipient of a good deed, and so they feel a sense of gratitude and a sense of obligation, and maybe later, if they have a sandwich, they'll share with some other guy. So it's an all-around, you may say, virtuous transaction. But now I want to run the same transaction, but run it through the government with slight modifications. So let's follow the same transaction. I'm walking on the beach, I've got my sandwich, I open it up, I'm about to eat it, hungry guy shows up and he goes, "I'm hungry, give me half your sandwich." Now, let's say that I answer no. Now, in a sense, I'm not doing anything evil because it is my sandwich. It is mine to give. If he doesn't get it, he's no worse off than he was before. I'm not oppressing him. I'm merely not conferring a benefit on him. But nevertheless, I've said no. And now something interesting happens. I hear a galloping. And here's Obama on a white horse. He shows up. He dismounts and he puts a gun to my head. And he goes, "Hand that man half your sandwich." And so I do. And so the outcome is the same as in my earlier example. The other guy ends up with half a sandwich. But now let's follow the actual transaction. First of all, I am a reluctant giver. I was not going to give him the sandwich. I'm forced. I have a gun to my head. It's no virtue to me because I'd rather give up the sandwich than have my brains blown out. So I just chose the lesser evil. I deserve no credit. The guy who gets the sandwich, far from feeling appreciative, he feels entitled. "Oh crap, only half a sandwich. Where's the other half, man? I'm really hungry." In other words, he's entitled. And so what I'm getting at is the same transaction that would be a beautiful and virtuous transaction if it were voluntary and in the private sector becomes a monstrous transaction. In fact, if you look at this transaction of the horseman dismounting and putting a gun to my head, if someone tried that in the private sector, they would be considered an outlaw and sent to prison.
No, don't shout at me. I'm defending fascism. No, I'm exposing you as a fascist. Because... Do you realize, I'll tell you how. You asked me a question. Hold on. Are you familiar with the black shirts in Italy or the brown shirts in Germany? Do you realize that they would go to campuses, goons, and would stand in the back of the room, and when somebody tried to make an intelligent presentation and answer questions, they would shout them down, yell at them, try to intimidate them, and count as success if they could get the event canceled and the speaker threatened. But see, the problem is, sometimes you get speakers like me who are not scared of people like you. We recognize your frauds. I recognize that ultimately you are afraid of ideas. You're not willing to engage with me. Yes, you're afraid of ideas. You're not afraid of fascists. You think I pose a threat to you? I'm an immigrant. I came to America with nothing. What threat do I pose to you?
Yeah, Now, if we're saying that it's absolutely impossible to give that money back because it's too hard to trace, we'd have to give money to the African tribes, we'd have to give money to people who are, no longer exist, that's absolutely fine. But we have to understand that we haven't really come to terms with that injustice that's been perpetrated. And if we are admitting that no one is perfectly entitled to absolutely everything that their ancestors had stolen from them, then we also have to accept that there are people today who benefit from the fact that their parents and grandparents profited from this immoral system. And the way to deal with that is with a social safety net that enables everyone to thrive. I'll leave you there.
Now, the first thing I'm trying to say is this is a hugely controversial principle because it actually involves wrecking the freedom of a free society. You basically have to put it frankly, if we were to carry that out, go into people's homes and take their stuff, take their furniture, take their cars. You don't seem to have even the guts to do that. You don't have the moral self-confidence to do it yourself. It may be, if I am advocating a rule of social justice and I'm advocating it for the whole society, before I persuade everybody else, let's say I'm a Christian and I believe everybody should give 10% of their wealth to help the poor. And I go, you know what? The Bible says this, the Bible says that, everybody should give 10% of their wealth to help the poor. And somebody says, Dinesh, are you giving 10% of your wealth? And I'm like, actually, no, but I did do some tutoring. And you go, wait a minute, aren't you advocating? Aren't you saying that there is a moral duty to do this? Why don't you do it?
That I'm saying that the Southern economy was essentially a non-capitalist economy. Its champions knew that. The defenders of slavery all attacked capitalism.
But
they hated
capitalism. It was in the pursuit of profit, which has continued on since then through the Jim Crow law eras, since the establishment of private prisons. And it's, you know, it's happening to this day. It hasn't changed. It's been capitalism since this country has been founded, and that capitalism is rooted in the slavery of this country.
The dictator of Venezuela, Maduro, right? When he died, he was a billionaire. So he was obviously in pursuit of profit. He was a socialist who was looting the country for himself. Was he a capitalist because he cared about profit? No, because capitalism is not just about caring about profit. Capitalism is about a certain way of going about business that actually mutually enriches all the parties involved. Otherwise, they don't do the transaction. If I go to apply for a job at a company, and let's just say they offer to pay me $1 an hour, right? And let's just say that I say, that's scandalous, that's slavery wages. If I don't take the job, I'm no worse off than I was before. They haven't exploited me in any way. They're offering me a deal. I'm free to take it or not. It's completely different if they go grab me, put a chain around my neck, and make me work. That's the opposite of capitalism. That's why, read Lincoln. Lincoln says slavery is you work, I eat. And the alternative for him is the hand that makes the corn gets to put the corn in its own mouth. For Lincoln, that's capitalism. The Scandinavian model is really simple. Everyone benefits. And everyone has to pay. In other words, this is not a soak the rich scheme. The highest tax rates in Scandinavia, 60, 70, and 80%, kick in on the middle class. If you make $50,000 in Scandinavian countries, you're in the 50% tax bracket. Not only are you at that rate, there's a 25% VAT tax on everything you buy, which is a regressive tax that hits the poor more than it hits the rich. The Scandinavians are into soaking the poor, and they don't make any bones about it. Their point is, if you want this package of benefits, we have the right to take half your stuff. Now, contrast this with the deceitful way in which people like AOC and we're not going to go after, they don't even have the guts to say they're going to go after the upper middle class. They go, we're going to go after the billionaires. There are 300 billionaires in America. We're going to go after the billionaires. So in other words, what you have in American, well, Scandinavian socialism is, I call it unification socialism. Everybody's in the same boat. American socialism is division socialism. Let's take society, divide it as many ways we can, intensify hatred toward the group that is being demonized. So intensify hatred, for example, of the black against the white. The illegal against the legal, the poor against the rich, the gay against the straight,
And so what you get is this thing that's now called intersectionality, which I guess is a marriage of all these different types of divisions. I want to suggest that is the very and exact opposite of what they do in Scandinavia. They don't do that. Now, very interestingly, there is one place in the world where all these features of American socialism are in fact present. And that country is indeed Venezuela.
Soviet Union. Why did Hitler consider Stalin his greatest enemy and consider that Lebensraum to the east was the way to go and killed 80% of sent 80% of his soldiers to fight the Soviets if they were basically the same ideology?
Very good question, which is if Nazism and communism are both leftist, how come they went to war? First of all, it's important to realize that ideologies that are very close to each other frequently do go to war. The Catholics and the Protestants, the Shia and the Sunni. The Shia and the Sunni are both in the House of Islam. They actually agree on 99% of theological beliefs, but they've been fighting for centuries. Why? Competitions over territory and power and so on. Remember that Hitler was a national socialist. The reason that Hitler hated the communists was not because they were socialists. He liked that part about it. What he didn't like is that they were taking their orders from Moscow. He saw them as traitors to Germany. So Hitler's priority was socialism in Germany. Now remember that Hitler, who went to war with Stalin, was allied with Stalin. So on the foreign policy domain, Hitler was perfectly happy to sign the Hitler-Stalin Pact and then violate it for reasons of national interest. So the bottom line of it is the fact that Germany and the Soviet Union went to war in no way refutes the idea that progressivism, communism, and fascism were all three sister movements that developed in Germany, in Italy, in America, and in Russia, all in response to the crisis of Marxism. The reason I mention this is not to refute him, but to say as I'm listening to him talk, it occurred to me, wow.
Get the fuck out of here!
Yeah.
Fuck you.
All right. All right. See, this is the acceptable bigotry of the left. This is the acceptable bigotry of the left in which... You have this lousy beneficiary of white privilege. Right? Now, if he knew an ounce of history, he would sit here, listen to me, and stand up and ask a question that will show me up. But he won't do that. He won't do that because he's a thug. He's a thug who wants to shout me down. That's all he knows how to do. Open debate is not racist. Open debate is very healthy in an academic community. Racial denigration is racist. So I ask you in fairness. I've been up here now speaking. If you believe the posters and the dissenters and the comments and the Stanford paper and so on, you might have expected me to stand up and give you 45 minutes of racial invective. So a very good way to test these things is to ask you, have you heard me say anything tonight that you would consider racist? And if not, why would you even raise that term in my connection?
So I will concede to you, I did not hear anything explicitly racist, and I do have to say I appreciate that. Thank you.
The bottom line of it is you don't get to jump the line. That's lawlessness. And not only is it lawlessness, but those of us who come from countries far away, this jumping of the line hurts us more than it hurts anybody else. It hurts legal immigrants standing in line from a long distance away who can't jump a fence and can't swim the Rio Grande. It hurts us much more than it hurts native-born Americans because our lives are hanging by a thread and these jerks jump ahead of us. And it doesn't matter that they're looking for a better life. We are too.
The Second Amendment does not exist for hunting. It's not ultimately about the fact that some people like to go shoot deer and they need sports weapons to do that. The real purpose of the First Amendment is to protect the citizens from their own government, from the risk of government tyranny. Okay? That's why it's there. That's why it's there. Now, the progressives want to dominate the state. and they want to have increasing state control over the lives of citizens. Having an armed citizenry is a major check on that. And I believe that ultimately that's what drives gun control. Because think about it. What gun control policy could have prevented Las Vegas? Even Dianne Feinstein said, I can't even think of any. Number two, what purpose is served by taking guns away from law-abiding citizens if your point is actually to prevent non-law-abiding citizens from killing them? Remember, Rahm Emanuel's never let a good crisis go to waste. So whenever there's some panic, they actually hope to ride the panic to pass a law that may even seem senseless 3 weeks later, but you did it in a panic. And so the use of crisis is, by the way, the fascists were like experts at this. They used the Reichstag fire was what Hitler used to get the Enabling Act passed, which gave him essentially supreme power over Nazi Germany. He didn't have it before that. The parliament gave it to him. And he used some say a manufactured crisis, that's debated by scholars, but nevertheless a crisis in order to claim that power.
My question for you is more based on discourse. In a climate right now with what's going on outside and what can happen in here, the word bigot being thrown around, how do we maintain a level of intellectual discourse that keeps conversation happening instead of not happening?
This use of the word bigot, you got to be very careful, because when I was here at Dartmouth, I was a freshman here in the aftermath of what's called the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. And it was all these guys who were like, free speech, free speech, free speech. And we supported them. Our newspaper on campus was partly modeled on the Berkeley barb that was behind this kind of activism. It's only later I realized that when those guys take control, they will immediately start suppressing the speech of others. In other words, they don't actually believe in free speech. They believe in free speech for them. Bigot is a very loaded term. And because it has real sting and applies to real people, there's an effort to try to pin it on people. See, like these guys are walking out, they're too lazy to debate with me. They're not going to. I mean, they aren't. They aren't. Because, I'll tell you why. Hold on. Look, I'm here. I'm here.
Respect this institution, though, you would, think about that. Like, if you respect the institution and the standards that this institution upholds, for you to say that they're lazy is kind of,
I'm not saying that they're lazy people. I'm simply saying that they are not willing to do the intellectual work to stand up face to face with me. Look, if I said those things on those posters, and if I believe them, and if they're all true, this is a slam dunk against me. All someone has to do is stand up here, quote my own words back to me in the complete confidence that I would have no rebuttal, right? And crush me. And I'm saying they can't do that, and they're not going to. Or if they will, I'm actually anticipating that and waiting for it. But it hasn't happened yet. So I'm just saying that the enemy of free speech is not me. The enemy of free speech are the people who would rather have that I never came, that they never would have to have that kind of debate, that they would win this confrontation by default.